The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
He's the duly elected president, and they had an opportunity to serve and wanted to help him get better and help him learn. And what they have found is that as they've resigned or been fired over time, they've been replaced by enablers. They're not replaced by new guardrails. I mean, Rex Tillerson is out, and in his place as Secretary of State is Mike Pompeo, who not only has tried to enforce and enact and execute the president's will all around the world, but enabled Rudy Giuliani to be a shadow diplomat in Ukraine. You know, John Kelly saw himself as a human guardrail inside the West Wing, and he's been replaced by an acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, who's basically a yes man and gets everything the president wants done, including withholding the aid to Ukraine. And so it's a different environment now. And I think these people who served initially recognized that had they resigned in month one, they might have been replaced by enablers right away. And so, you know, that Mattis stayed on for 2 years, he would probably defend that and feel like he protected a lot in those 2 years.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 29th, 2020. Philip Rucker and Carol Lenning are reporters at the Washington Post and the authors of the new book, A Very Stable Genius: Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. This week, Susan Hennessy sat down with Rucker and Lenning to talk about their new book. They talked about the president's interactions with his cabinet, his attitude toward the law, and the efficacy of his public attacks. And they delved into a few of the scenes depicted in the book. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 515, Philip Rucker and Carol Lenning on A Very Stable Genius.
Thanks so much for joining me this morning. Welcome. Congratulations on the tremendous success of the book.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you.
It is remarkable. I think you guys have now spent 2 weeks at number one in the New York Times bestseller list. Is that accurate?
I think we were number one for the first week, and we've been steady number two ever since.
Excellent. Debuts at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. That's fantastic, and the book really is something quite different than a lot of Trump books that we've seen, just in the richness and depth and care of sort of the details and reporting. So I want to sort of start with that. How did you come to write this book? So how did you conceptualize what the project was, what the time frame was, the organization? Sort of in your minds, tell me, how is it that this came to be when you have pretty crazy day jobs?
You know, part of the reason that Phil and I decided to do the book is because our day jobs were so crazy. We were in the middle of history literally unfolding in front of our eyes every day. We really couldn't remember sometimes the shocking story we wrote earlier in the week. By the time Friday rolled around, it was a dizzying array of chyrons, scandals, shocking developments. And we wanted to hit the pause button and make sense of this history that was so unprecedented. We'd never experienced anything like it. It wasn't exactly the best in terms of timing for writing a book while writing for the newspaper every day. And we both had pretty demanding schedules. Phil is White House bureau chief, so he's covering the president literally on the hook for writing about him every week. But I think it was the right thing to do because we saw something deeper than what we learned in our day-to-day reporting. We saw patterns and themes that we and even new details that we hadn't spotted the first time around.
And at the outset, did you decide what the time frame was that you were going to cover, right? So you could have waited a year, you could have done it a year earlier. How did you decide sort of on this particular moment and this presentation of time and facts?
Yeah, you know, we knew from the outset when we wanted the book to begin, and that's pretty easy when Trump wins the election. But you're right that the end point when we put our pencil down, so to speak, was a moving target throughout the process, and we kept trying to think about, you know, when is the natural endpoint for this story. And we reached a point in the middle of last year, 2019, when we felt, you know what, we have so much interesting new revelatory reporting here that we felt an urgency to share that with the public right away, not to wait till the end of the first term concludes, not to wait, for example, till the end of the second term or the third term or the fourth term, which Trump teases about. But we also saw a natural endpoint with the conclusion of the Russia investigation. And when Robert Mueller, the special counsel, finished his work and testified before Congress, there was a sort of narrative arc there to our story. And Trump set out on the campaign trail at that point to officially launch his reelection campaign. The dawn of impeachment began, and that just felt to us like the point where we would put our pen down and write this story and get it published.
Yes, you mentioned there's new revelatory information and details in this book, and there certainly is. There's more than we could possibly cover sort of in the scope of a 40-minute or an hour-long podcast. How do you negotiate between yourselves and sort of with your day jobs of deciding what information to hold back and present in the book in sort of a fuller context versus stories that you're breaking every day? I mean, in some sense, you're actually going back and re-reporting stories that you guys wrote in the first place. So, like, how does that process work?
You know, we really had wonderful guides, Susan, in our editors at the Washington Post, and a good standard that they helped us set, which was, you know, of course, you're writing a book, you're going to tell new information that people have never read before. But that standard that Phil and I followed was so helpful. It was essentially, if you think you come across something that really dramatically changes the narrative as we understand it now, or that is something the public absolutely must have at their fingertips for making decisions, that it changes the nature of what they know about the president, then it has to be reported now. And indeed, many of our sources only agreed. We spoke with more than 200 people. Many of them only agreed to speak to us and break their silence for the book. They wanted to have us get history right. They hadn't talked to us before. But in this case, in some cases, when it met that standard, when it went over that bar, those sources, we went to them and we explained, this needs to be in the newspaper. It needs to be in the newspaper now. And they agreed.
And did you actually go back and re-interview sources? So, you know, there's a lot of reporting on, for example, you know, the Mueller investigation and the president's relationship with the Justice Department, and certainly sort of the early days and months of his administration. You know, did you go back and have the conversation again 6 months or a year later with the same people? Were they more open?
Yeah.
Do they forget amidst sort of the chaos and craziness? I mean,
so almost all of the scenes and the dialogue in our book is from reporting that was original to this book. So a lot of the moments and episodes were things that were chronicled in the paper at the time. There are episodes that played out, for example, in the Mueller report. But Carol and I went back to all of these primary sources to do in-depth, you know, hours-long interviews for the book and really dig deeper and really try to fill in the holes and understand exactly what was happening behind the scenes. And we found in almost all of these episodes, there was more to learn and more dynamics, more pieces of information to the stories than we knew in real time. And in some cases, even more than Robert Mueller and his team were able to find out for the purposes of their investigation.
Yeah, so you've now sort of covered this presidency and this White House both as reporters and also as authors, which is a little bit of a different task. This president is in some ways far less transparent and available than prior presidents have been. They don't do weekly or daily White House press briefings. a lot of things that the president says aren't necessarily true or shouldn't be taken at face value. On the other hand, there's a strange openness to it, right? It's actually really remarkable that somebody could write a book like this about a sitting president. It's remarkable that the president tweets, that he constantly stops and has these sort of impromptu, you know, press gaggles as he's getting in and out of a helicopter. You know, as journalists and as authors, is this president more accessible than prior presidents, less accessible, just different, right? How should we sort of understand his access or what covering him is like versus prior and potentially future presidents?
You know, I definitely want to hear what Phil has to say about this too. But my first reaction is that it's a completely different experience because he is tweeting and he is stepping into the circular driveway every other day, sometimes every day, sometimes the South Lawn, just sharing his views and giving reporters exactly what's coming out of his mind unfiltered, sometimes in the back of the plane, talking on background or off the record. So in a way, he's really available. But on the other hand, it's really hard to vet information with his White House. We're now to the stage where it's almost impossible to get a callback or response by email for a daily story about, hey, just want to check with you. We're writing this story. It says X. So that's really problematic. And also, as you point out, Susan, the president doesn't always say things that are accurate. And so sometimes you will find his aides playing cleanup later. The president tweets X, and all day long, his aides are trying to carefully recalibrate and restate what he said to make sure it's in line with White House policy and strategy.
So you both have kind of talked about the book as an opportunity to step back, to tell a deeper story, give a fuller portrait of what's happening in this White House. And you write that Trump is driven by self-centered and unthinking logic, but a logic nonetheless. And so it seems like sort of one of the themes of the book is this notion that there are patterns, there is big takeaway, this isn't just chaos. There actually is some logic, however sort of strange it might be. So what is it, right? What is the takeaway that you want people to have from this book in terms of what is happening inside the White House?
So it's a great question, Susan. It's really easy to watch this all unfold every day and think it's uninhibited chaos. And to some degree it is. I mean, the White House from day one of this presidency has been a den of dysfunction, just chaos all the time. But there's a logic to what the president's doing, and there's a North Star, if it were, and that's the perpetuation of his own power, his, you know, scramble every day for political survival, his desire to amass and maintain his power, to create the self-image and burnish the self-image that he sees of himself as the greatest, the best. You know, his critics say it's clearly narcissism, but there's an ego here at play. And the president's always trying to look out for himself and his image and how to promote himself. And that's the logic and the pattern behind almost everything he does and almost everything that his government is doing to support him. We see this week he's in India for this trip. There's not a lot of substance happening on that trip, but there is a huge rally with 110,000 people in a cricket stadium, an extraordinary display put on by the Indian prime minister, clearly to play to this president's ego and help him burnish that self-image he has of himself.
So one of the things you guys really do well in this book, I think, is sort of take these pivotal moments, right, and really tease them out of these are moments that are sort of critical to the path of this presidency and these interactions that seem to really shape what happens moving forward. And right, so I'm thinking of one where you describe this meeting in the tank at the Pentagon in which, you know, Trump is meeting with his generals. You know, this is something that I think every newspaper in the world jumped on the day the book came out of, you know, he calls his generals dopes and babies as, you know, the rhetorical flourish that only the the president brings to each and every situation. You know, and it's sort of describing, right, the attempt by people who work for the president to help shape his views and influence him and help him govern and govern themselves and the failures and the misfires and the way that actually sets the president on quite a different course. And, you know, one thing I was struck by as I was sort of reading one after another, and I really think that's the power of the book is reading them one after another. was this all inevitable? As you sort of tell these stories in these moments, do you think that, you know, if Jim Mattis had been more sensitive in this meeting about not condescending to the president, if his early handlers had gotten him in a different way, would things have been different? Or is this all, is there just an inevitability because it's all subsumed by the personal ego?
You know, Phil and I can't be in President Trump's head, but what we can say is what we've had dozens of people who work alongside his shoulder month after month tell us. And what they tell us is that the president almost is insulted by what most presidents consider the norm. I have a staff. They have expertise. They come to me and they try to inform me. But the president doesn't like that. He views it as annoying to have a lot of, or he reacts in a way, they say, that is very annoyed when he's brought this sort of schoolhouse rock presentation at the tank. It wasn't condescending, by the way, according to the people that were there. These aides and senior advisors, Tillerson, Mattis, former Secretary of State, Gary Cohn, former National Economic Advisor, these folks were trying to say, hey, we want to explain to you about these bases, these troops, these treaties, and how they keep us safe. It was not talking down to him, but the president didn't care. He didn't want to hear a lot of lecturing, as has been true throughout his presidency. He doesn't like briefings. He likes charts and graphics and sticky notes that have his name on them prominently. This feature of his presidency, I think, is inevitable in a way because, as he describes himself, he's a game day player. He doesn't need anybody's help. As he told Tillerson, when Tillerson tried to explain to him about Vladimir Putin trying to exploit the U.S., don't worry, I met him. I've got this.
So one thing that's really interesting about this scene, you know, in which the president is berating these various generals and DOD officials, and Tillerson sort of speaks up on their behalf, you know, you describe Tillerson as realizing that Jim Mattis is genetically a Marine, and so he actually can't speak out against the commander-in-chief because it's just not part of his constitution. I think it's really sort of significant because, of course, Jim Mattis is the Secretary of Defense. In that moment, it's a civilian role. And actually, the reason why we have a civilian Secretary of Defense is because you don't want a military Secretary of Defense, right? This idea of civilian control, the ability to push back, the idea of external accountability. And so obviously this book is about Trump, but as we sort of understand the players around him, people like Jim Mattis, were they completely clear-eyed or were they kidding themselves to some degree, either about their own capacity to really fill these roles and people like Mattis to sort of step into civilian shoes or their persuasion or their understanding of the man? I mean, what sort of is your takeaway of these really fascinating characters that are around him, many of whom washed out early, but some of whom have sort of endured?
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting point to think about, Susan. And for starters, I would say there are no perfect heroes in our book. You know, not even Mattis, not Tillerson, not even Robert Mueller, the special counsel. Everybody who's worked for Trump or interacted with him over these 3 years has had some flaws in the way they've conducted himself. And I think a lot of the people in the room that day at the tank thought Mattis as the Secretary of Defense, as the person that Trump has appointed to lead the military, but in a civilian capacity, as you point out, might have confronted him or might have challenged him or might have stood up to speak on behalf of those who wear the uniform, who were being so disrespected by the president, but he didn't. There was another person in the room who was silent in that moment that surprised a lot of people, and that was Vice President Pence. He was described to Carol and to me as like a wax museum figure in that moment. He said nothing. When Trump called the war in Afghanistan a loser war, you know, Mike Pence's son has been in the military and has served in Afghanistan. And Pence never stood up to say, that's not a loser war. The people fighting there are not losers. He didn't even defend his own son. And it speaks to the power and control that the president has, and this particular president has, where he has no tolerance for betrayal. He has no tolerance for hearing no from his advisors. I mean, if Mattis had stood up and confronted him in that room, you wonder if he would have been the Secretary of Defense the next day. He might not have been. And so there's a calculation that these figures are making every day that they're working for Trump about how far can they push the boundaries, the envelope, in dealing with him and still hold on to their jobs. And it's not because they want that power themselves in their jobs. It's because Mattis thought that him being the Secretary of Defense was helping protect against a calamity, that the president had such flawed judgment when it came to military affairs that somebody like Mattis needed to be there to really stand in the way if it were a matter of life and death.
So why don't you think we hear from these people now, especially people who have since left the administration? You know, obviously you guys aren't able to talk about sources, but people who I would assume do talk to reporters and people who are writing books about the administration and are willing to have those off-the-record conversations, but we haven't heard give sort of full-throated, you know, warning or insight or even just factual account of what happened and what's true and what's false, especially as the president is saying that things are made up and the reporters are making things up or that members of Congress are making things up. You know, and not to pick on Jim Mattis, there's a long list of people that fill that, you know, that sort of occupy this category. You know, why don't you think that we've seen more people post sort of their administration tenure come out and talk about it?
You know, on the road in the last couple of weeks, it's a question we get from almost every single group of people who are listening to us talk about the book. Almost with some anger, people are going, why don't they stand up? And, you know, many of the sources who spoke with us shared with us two things. Either A, they didn't want it to be anonymous because they don't believe in criticizing a sitting commander in chief, and or far more prominently, they fear the president, the bully pulpit, and the way he uses it. He's a master of the megaphone with his base, but he's also a master of coming at people and trying to humiliate them, using his Twitter handle to go at people in a really vicious way. And you've seen that with, I mean, somebody who basically just complied with the law, a legal subpoena, somebody ultimately as low ranking as Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who agreed to testify because he was subpoenaed to do so, told the truth about what he did on his job, which was his job at the National Security Council, to listen to the phone calls between the president and a foreign leader. And watching that kind of hatchet job on that person, you kind of understand why people are afraid. There are also senior folks who've had difficulty in their future careers, in their ongoing careers, because they did work for Trump and it came with a stain and a tarnish that's been problematic for them. And having the wrath of the president on top of that is not something they're cherishing.
So one of the most fascinating parts of this book for me is sort of rereading the story of the Mueller investigation and going back and learning, frankly, being reminded of a lot of stuff that was sort of easy to forget that it happened in the moment, and also sort of layering on new details. It's one thing that I'm remain a little bit bewildered that sort of it's vanished from the public conversation, right? This discussion of the findings of the Mueller report and sort of the significance of that investigation. And I want to posit something and get your reactions to it. And that's that one of the problems is that you two and your colleagues were too good at your jobs. And what happened was we had the press who was really on top of this story, that was reporting it in real time, in some sense was getting ahead of the special counsel's office, certainly has been able to even fill in some details that the special counsel appeared to have missed or not to have fully pursued. And so when the Mueller report came out, most of it we'd actually already read before. Do you think it would have had a different impact if instead of it sort of being a golden age of investigative journalism, it really had been new information? Or is that just sort of actually nothing ever sticks to this president and sort of that's a revisionist account of what history might have looked like?
I think it certainly would have pierced the public's consciousness more had this all come out at once and been more of a surprise that the president had sought to obstruct justice so many times. I don't know that the outcome would have been different. And what I mean by the outcome is, you know, Mueller would not have arrived at a different conclusion about whether to charge the president. And I'm not sure that the Congress would have acted in any way that they didn't act based on the Mueller report itself. There clearly was a willingness among the Republicans in the Senate to tune it out and sort of ignore the evidence of presidential wrongdoing. That said, the public impact of the Mueller report was certainly blunted by the fact that so many of these episodes we knew about beforehand, but it was also blunted by Mueller's sort of unwillingness or inability, rather, to play in the sandbox in the 21st century with Trump and with his attorney general, Bill Barr. We show in a lot of detail behind the scenes in those final weeks of the investigation the extent to which Barr outmaneuvered Mueller, and Mueller didn't really know how to play this PR battle with the president and the attorney general, who were trying to leave a public impression that the president was exonerated, that he did nothing wrong, that he had not sought to obstruct justice, when in fact the report and the investigation found the opposite.
So tell us a little bit about this sort of, you know, what happened in those final days in which Barr really does kind of outfox Mueller?
It's actually a little bit depressing in one way, because one person has a lot of great facts, and I would argue that that Mueller's report, in a telescopic and cinematic way, brought a lot of new details that reporters had not unearthed to the fore. But one guy had all the facts and one guy had all the PR. And when Mueller is operating as a 1950s sort of priest and Barr is operating as a PR genius, Barr wins. In those last moments, Mueller, right before he's about to finalize his report, comes to a meeting with Barr and his deputies to explain to him, in I think it's early March, hey, I just want you to know what the report's going to generally say. And it's also, we're not going to conclude that the president engaged in anything criminal. We don't believe we can make such an assessment, because if we can't charge a sitting president, then we can't make an accusation of criminal conduct. That decision floors Barr and his deputies, but they end up taking some good advantage of it by basically saying, okay, could a future prosecutor conclude, Mr. Mueller, that there is not enough evidence of obstruction? Mueller gives him the opening and says, yes, a future prosecutor could conclude that there wasn't enough evidence of obstruction. And that's exactly what Barr does. In a four-page summary that he issues to the public, he basically says there's not evidence of obstruction and there's not evidence of collusion. And on the first point, it's not really true.
So one thing that's remarkable about both the answers you just gave and also sort of scattered throughout this book is it describes the president breaking the law, or it describes the president engaging in conduct in which a reasonable person could believe he either was breaking the law or was trying to break the law. And it's really just statements of fact, right? That, you know, he wants to do something with the border wall and he's told, well, that's illegal. It's against the law. And he says, well, do it anyway, right? And we've seen lots of presidents that, you know, they have instincts and they want people to facilitate those instincts, but they at least recognize the law as being something they have to at least pretend to care about or attempt to comply with. And yet there are dozens of sort of casual examples throughout this book of the president just not caring, kind of from the earliest days of divestment and ethics regulations through to obstruction, all the way through sort of impeachment. And in some sense, I think if we were to open Twitter right now, there would be some new thing that has occurred since we sat down. And so I don't think it's overly editorializing to say this sort of astonishing lawlessness of a president. You know, what should we make of this? Does he just not care? Does he have authoritarian impulses where he actually doesn't believe he should be constrained by the law? Like, what are people who read this book and I think would be reasonably justified in feeling terrified sort of to make of that? Because if there's one theme that unites a lot of these stories that come from really different contexts, it's that. It's disregard of the law.
Yeah, I love, Susan, how you pointed out that these are just statements of fact, because that's how Carol and I view this book. I mean, we're not we're not equipped or credentialed to decide whether somebody's breaking the law or not. But that said, there's a clear pattern here of the president testing those boundaries and testing the rule of law in our country. And it's been this way from day one. And the reason that it's continuing and even expanding in these last few weeks is because every time he crosses that line, every time he does something that, you know, thousands of prosecutors would deem lawless or a violation of our law, he has not faced accountability. We saw that through the Mueller investigation, where he was not held accountable for his multiple instances of trying to obstruct justice and stymie that investigation, which is a violation of the law, and got off without any consequence. And so then the next day, after Mueller testifies in Congress, he picks up the phone to call the president of Ukraine to ask a favor, a political favor. Again, a violation of the law for which he was not held accountable by the Senate in the impeachment trial. And so he's becoming increasingly emboldened. And based on our reporting, he believes to some degree that he is above the law because he's the president of the United States. And that's not only his opinion. It's based on and borne out through his experiences in office over these 3 years where he's not been held to account.
It's 3 years in of covering this president. Phil, I think you even covered Trump as a candidate, so even longer. Are you still surprised by things? Were you surprised by things you found in the course of reporting the book? Are you surprised by things you find out in the ordinary sort of course of daily reporting? Or is it all a part of this pattern and actually nothing should really be surprising? I mean, how has your sort of sense of this changed? Did you see it coming in those earliest days of sort of covering Trump rallies? Or do you still sort of step back and say, whoa, this is, you know, a once in a lifetime story, except for the fact that you've told this story, you know, 500 times?
You know what I like about what Phil just described about the president overcoming a lot of very serious criminal allegations, essentially, allegations of wrongdoing, allegations of abuse of power, and surviving and cresting that wave every time, is our book does foreshadow essentially where we are today. But even Phil and I think, are a little surprised by the degree to which, you know, what his aides called the Jabba the Hutt bar, you know, those early aides that nobody understood how in the world they were in the transition team and how in the world these people with such low credentials could become advisors to a president and a White House. We see, you know, essentially the nature of that Jabba the Hutt bar now back in charge. People are returning to office who were booted in some cases because senior advisors who had chops didn't feel they were qualified for the work. Those people are back. The last 2 weeks, the president has taken direct aim at the Justice Department. He's taken direct aim at prosecutors making decisions without fear or favor, which is the standard of our blind justice system. I don't think we predicted that. And yet these last 2 weeks, this president unbound, we did predict that quality, just not the degree to which he would feel so unchained and willing to go after things that really Americans hold dear and that our country is built on.
Has the president learned lessons? So for better or worse, you described the past 2 weeks in which the president is now overtly targeting sort of the fundamentals of an independent Department of Justice and this notion of apolitical law enforcement. There's a form of learning inherent in that, right? Learning how to be better at wielding, at least I would argue, and I won't impute this to you, but I would argue sort of a corrupt vision of the presidency. But there are other areas that feel pathological and right, as if you're kind of telling the same story over and over again, this person who kind of never quite learns his lesson, never quite learns that if he just did things a little bit differently, if he just listened to these people, if he just could temper his rhetoric, he actually might be able to accomplish more. Which account is accurate, right? Is this a president who has changed in the office, who has learned one way or another and has evolved, or is this really just the same guy that walked in on January 20th, you know, 2017?
You know, it's both, actually. He is the same Donald Trump who campaigned for the presidency in 2015 and 2016 and walked into office after the inauguration. And a lot of the things he's been doing are things that he said on the campaign trail that he would do. So there's no surprise there. But he has learned a lot in this job. He has grown and become very confident in his use of power. And a couple of the things he's learned now as we're in year four of the presidency, he's learned that the Republican Party in Congress is going to be almost completely compliant with whatever he wants to do, that he has such a powerful hold on Republican voters and on the base electorate out in the country that he can talk his way out of anything with his allies on Capitol Hill. And that's new, and that's something he's learned through impeachment. The other thing he's learned is how to maneuver within the federal bureaucracy and how to bend it to his will. He's now booted the head of presidential personnel and brought in a 29-year-old loyalist, Johnny McEntee, with an explicit directive to root out all of the snakes, all the leakers, all the people in the government who are suspected of not being loyal enough to this president, to fire them, replace them, find dissenters within the intelligence apparatus, within the national security community. Like, this is a big deal. It is not normal. And the only reason it's happening is because the president has figured out how to do it. And he's confident in his power to get that done and to make these sorts of changes, not only within the political appointee ranks, but in the civil service as well.
I think he's also learned, I would just add to that those great points, that bullying works. You know, going after people has been very successful and effective, and people are afraid of him and what he can say about them and how he can tarnish them.
And has the press learned, either collectively or the two of you sort of individually? Do you feel like you've learned more about how to cover this presidency, how to cover this White House in a way that's different than before? I mean, in some sense, the mere fact that you felt compelled to write a book and to step back is a little bit of an acknowledgement of the impossibility of actually telling the full story when it's just this deluge of constant stories. And have you changed the way you cover the president, the way you think about covering the president or the presidency, either just as he's learned and evolved over the past 3 years, and also sort of the experience of writing this book, has that changed kind of how you conceptualize the task?
One of my concerns about our coverage at the very beginning, and this is the duty of every newspaper covering a president, is to document what he says. But sometimes the president is creating a shiny ball in front of our face every day, a new one that we chase, and that we may not be always perfectly and adeptly capturing what's going on behind the scenes. I think that the news media has gotten smarter and smarter and smarter every month about that shiny ball and focusing on it as well as everything else, what's really happening inside this White House and not just what the man behind the curtain is doing with the shiny ball. I also thought it was really interesting what Margaret Sullivan wrote over the weekend about how we are in new territory in a way. Phil and I are not opinion writers. We're reporters. We capture the facts. But we are in new territory when you have a president creating an enemies list, enlisting a team of people to root out public servants who bring him facts, as he did with Joe McGuire. McGuire was always going to leave the Department of National Intelligence, but to root him out immediately after McGuire gave him factual information about Russia trying to interfere in the 2020 election is a new era. And we're going to have to find our way through that. And I think Margaret's right about it.
So you sort of present in the book, you know, speaking of people like McGuire and people who serve and are pushed out and survive and these various figures as sort of falling roughly into two camps, and correct me if I'm wrong here. There's sort of the people who are kind of true believers, and then there are people who sort of appear to believe that their role is to kind of protect the country from Trump, and that they're serving because they think that they can maybe temper some of his worst impulses or channel them into the public good. And the back cover of your book is really remarkable. It just has a series of anonymous quotes from people who have served, maybe are currently continuing to serve in this administration. And they say things like, quote, "I served the man for 2 years. I think he's a long-term and immediate danger to the country," end quote. Quote, "He's totally ignorant of everything, but he doesn't care. He's not interested," end quote. Quote, "The guy is completely crazy. The story of Trump, a president with horrible instincts and a senior-level cabinet playing whack-a-mole." There are others, and they only sort of get worse from there. You know, you talk about the fact that there are no perfect heroes here. Specifically for that group who believes that they are defending the country from the president or serving the president by channeling his impulses into the national interests, are they kidding themselves? Or, right, are what they really doing is facilitating maybe a slightly less worse version, or actually just facilitating Trump's impulses outright, or telling themselves a story, well, I'm not going to resign over this thing, or I'm not going to stand up to him over this thing because I might need to be there tomorrow or the next day or the next day, and are just sort of walking themselves down this kind of road to perdition of self-justifying and facilitating. You know, you talked, I think you said something like 200 sources for this book. You know, what is your gut, or what is your gut of how history will judge these people 10 and 20 years? Will our collective understanding be that, you know, these were patriots who did their best and we will be grateful that they were there? Or will we say, no, you are telling yourselves a story and we all would have been better off and democracy would have been better off had you the very first time there was something that you might have resigned over or might have pushed back on the president, chose to take a stand there?
Yeah, well, it's a complicated question to think about. I would start out by saying we don't really know how history over the long run is going to judge these people or judge this president for that matter. They certainly convince themselves that they're doing good in this job for the reasons that you state, that there's a protective quality here and that they're trying to, you know, save the country from the reckless decisions of this president as they see it. But from day one, they joined the administration because they wanted Trump to succeed. You know, they may not be true believers and they may not all wear Make America Great Again hats, but most of them are Republicans. They believe in this president's agenda. They believe in conservative policies. They wanted to help him succeed. They saw that the will of the people, at least in the Electoral College, elected him president. And that's how our democracy works. And so he's the duly elected president. And they had an opportunity to serve and wanted to help him get better and help him learn. And what they have found is that as they've resigned or been fired over time, they've been replaced by enablers. They're not replaced by new guardrails. I mean, Rex Tillerson is out, and in his place as Secretary of State is Mike Pompeo, who not only has tried to enforce and enact and execute the president's will all around the world, but enabled Rudy Giuliani to be a shadow diplomat in Ukraine. You know, John Kelly saw himself as a human guardrail inside the West Wing, and he's been replaced by an acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney, who's basically a yes man and gets everything the president wants done, including withholding the aid to Ukraine. And so it's a different environment now. And I think these people who served initially recognized that had they resigned in month one, they might have been replaced by enablers right away. And so, you know, that Mattis stayed on for 2 years, he probably, we don't speak for Mattis, but he would probably defend that and feel like he protected a lot in those 2 years.
So since there's nothing that reporters like more than asking them to predict a fundamentally unknowable future, I'm going to do it. I'll finish by trying to do it one more time. And that's that one thing that seems significant in how history might judge these people, this president, is whether or not he wins re-election. If Trump does get a second term in office, what might that look like? Is it going to be a continuation? Is it going to be worse? What are the trends or patterns that you see in this book that you think if he has a second term in office, this will run rampant, or this will be different? Paint a picture of what it might look like so that if it comes to pass, we can hold it up against reality and say, see, you got this wrong and this wrong, which everybody always loves.
You know, we are reporters, fact gatherers. I appreciate that you don't want us to speculate, but what the book reporting has shown to me and to Phil is that past is prologue, and every emboldened moment got more emboldened with each invincibility moment the president experienced. And the last 2 weeks tell me, at least, that we're in the second term, assuming there is one. This president is going to break all sorts of other norms, shake up this snow globe called Washington, possibly break some of the glass. But I think we can expect to see that public servants, the way they view their jobs, the way they view a certain pristine quality to governing, that that's going to be changed quite a bit.
I will leave it on that sunny and optimistic note. The book is A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. Phil Brucker and Carol Lenning, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Susan.
It was really great, Susan.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Carol Lenning and Philip Rucker for coming on the show. Their new book is called A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. Your audio engineer this week was me, Jacob Schultz, and the podcast is produced by Jen Patia-Howell. Your music, as always, is performed by Sophia Yan. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you subscribe. And please share us widely. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.